Hey everyone, it's Abu, and I'm here to share something really exciting that I've been working on for almost 6 months. Today on the Lore Party Podcast Network, my buddy Opsa and I are launching a new podcast called Science Fiction Book Club. As the name implies, it's a show where we'll be diving deep into the pages of our favorite sci-fi novels, both new and old. And since you're a Gam Jabbar listener, you basically already know what to expect. If you've enjoyed the Dune book clubs that Leo and I have done over the years, then you will love what Opsa and I are doing over on Science Fiction Book Club. We're basically taking that Dune book club formula that you know and love and translating it to the larger world of science fiction stories. And of course, we had to start with an absolute banger. So to kick off the show, Opsa and I will be diving into the pages of Three Body Problem, which, as you might already know, is being released as a Netflix show by the creators of Game of Thrones, which is also releasing today. Do you see what we did there? We launched our show the same day Netflix launched their show. We're playing it smart. So if this sounds like something you might be interested in, please go check out Science Fiction Book Club wherever you get your podcasts. There's also links in the show notes below. You can keep listening to hear the first episode of the show, but if you can't wait to hear more, then don't worry, because episode 2 is already out on the Science Fiction Book Club feed. So definitely go check that out. Thank you so much for your consideration, and we hope this is another journey that you'll be joining us on. As always, Leo and I will be back tomorrow with a brand new episode of Gam Jabbar. It's a silly one, so stay tuned. We'll see you on the Golden Path, folks.
More than 300 years, a dozen generations. When this podcast was but a seedling, it was still the Rogan era. During all these years, can you imagine how many storms it had weathered? How many events it had witnessed? But in a few minutes, you want to turn it off? You really feel nothing?
What do you want me to feel? It's just a podcast.
Welcome to Science Fiction Book Club, a podcast for bookworms and stargazers. In every episode, we dive into the pages of our favorite science fiction novels to break down the big ideas, ask the nerdy questions, and maybe learn a little bit about ourselves along the way. I'm your host, Opsa, and this is my co-host,
Abu. So happy to be here, Opsa.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh my gosh. Well, this is big because today we are going to be talking about the first three chapters of Three Body Problem.
Three chapters, three body. No problems there.
Not a single problem. I don't count any. But as always, before we get into today's reading and before we get into all of the deep sci-fi analysis nerdiness that we love to, let's take care of a quick bit of housekeeping for our listeners, starting with a spoiler warning. As the title states, today we're discussing the first three chapters of Three Body Problem. So we highly, highly recommend that you've read those three chapters before listening today. But if you haven't read past chapter 3, don't worry. We will not be discussing any plot details beyond the chapters assigned for today.
That's right. And we encourage you to read along with us and share your thoughts. Please do email us at scifibookclubpod@loreparty.com and join our Patreon at patreon.com/scifibookclubpod. We post free reading guides and discussion questions, as well as bonus clips and of course, bloopers on our Patreon. It's also where you can join our Discord to keep up with nerdy discussions and just to meet and mingle with the rest of the community.
That's right. We really encourage you to do that. The Patreon is free to start, so please go check it out, sign up, check out those reading guides, join the Discord, say hello to us, we'll be in there too. We really want this to feel like a book club. Now, all of those links will be in the show notes, so you don't have to write that down. Check out the show notes after you're done listening, and join our little geeky community. Now, with the housekeeping out of the way, here's a quick overview of how this episode will go. This is typically how we will tackle all of the episodes on this show. We will start the discussion by summarizing the chapters from today's reading. Again, that's chapters 1 to 3 today. Then we'll follow that up by sharing our first impressions and our thoughts of the chapters, and even any predictions we may have for what will happen later in the book. And then finally, we'll wrap up each episode by diving deep into our sci-fi analysis, talking about everything from the larger-than-life themes to the life of the author to many of the big ideas that these books tackle. Now, before we do that for Three Body Problem, Opsa, let's take a breather. Let's take a short break. But dear listener, don't go anywhere, because when we come back, we're getting into this iconic book.
Welcome back, listeners. And finally, we're at it. We get to dive into this really interesting book, Three Body Problem.
Yeah.
And we'll start with a brief summary.
Right.
So in this first chapter, we are dropped right into the middle of a struggle session during the height of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. A resilient physics professor is the target of a group of riled up Red Guards and is killed in the fervor of the crowd.
Ooh.
We tragically learn that he was the father of Ye Wenji, who had been fighting against the crowd to try to make it on stage. Absolutely devastating. We later come to learn that many of Ye's loved ones were victims of the Cultural Revolution. Her mother betrayed her father and went mad. Her sister was radicalized by the revolution and died in a rally.
Oh, yeah.
And her friend, Professor Ruin, died by suicide.
Oof. Brutal. I mean, this is a very tough way to start a book, and we'll talk about it in our thoughts in a bit here. But continuing with our summary, Ye ends up joining one of the many rural labor groups that were formed during the revolution at the time, and she ends up meeting a fellow intellectual named Bai Mulin. And the two connect in their love of nature and over this banned book that Bai lets Ye borrow. And this book dramatically changes her perspective on life and her perspective on humanity. Unfortunately, we are still in the midst of a cultural revolution, and so in order to save his own skin, Bai straight up throws Ye under the bus when he comes under political scrutiny.
Treacherous.
And this betrayal ultimately results in Ye being imprisoned. And while in prison, she's approached by an official and is offered a lesser sentence for her quote-unquote crime of being counter-revolutionary if she's willing to sign this mysterious document that just so happens to condemn her father as an anti-revolutionary. But to Ye's credit, she refuses. She chooses to stay imprisoned and to face the consequences of what's to come rather than condemn her father.
Yeah, betrayal and treachery so far. And shortly after her refusal here, you, of course, remember that the jailer, the guard offering her this plea deal, tosses cold water on her when she's
right.
Lying there on a cot in the cold.
And, yeah.
You know, really quite devastating.
It is.
Lucky for her, finally, the PLA soldiers from the mysterious Red Coast base need her special set of skills and advanced education. She gets whisked away to the base and offered a chance. Join their secretive mission and stay on the base for maybe her whole life, or return to prison and face judgment by the courts and likely have a quite shortened life after that.
Yeah.
But she doesn't hesitate for a second and immediately agrees to join the base. She wants effectively nothing to do with the outside world at this point, which is maybe understandable. The chapter ends as she witnesses some mysterious transmission being sent by the massive antenna that was atop of the Red Coast base, which causes birds to take flight and die, and the clouds to radiate blue. And that's scene.
And that's scene and chapter. Yeah.
And yeah.
Wow. I really liked in this chapter her lack of hesitation toward this. Like, she's busted out of prison. She finds herself in a helicopter. She recognizes one of the specialists of the PLA. It's someone that
That's
her
right.
father had once tutored, a grad student. And he recognizes her as well. And he's like, hey, this is like a top secret gig. You may never leave this base. Like, you could just die here.
Right.
And he's really pushing her to just go take some sort of plea deal with the courts, like face to judgment. You don't want to do this. You don't want to lose the rest of your life to this like super secret, top secret military mission. And she doesn't hesitate for a second. She's like, okay, well, I'm walking right in the door. Thanks.
Yeah.
And I think that shows us a lot of where her mentality is at after all she's faced in the Cultural Revolution so far.
Yeah. She clearly is standing as a symbol of something that is, that defies what we've been shown thus far, this betrayal and deception around her, that she stands in stark contrast to that. And there's something noble about that. And of course, her father as well, who was being persecuted during the struggle session for holding to what he and science? We know through science. Yeah. Like, they were basically accusing him of the heretical belief of relativity or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And that being counter-revolutionary.
Right. So. Yeah. Her father's resolute stance against the Red Guards, I found very admirable.
Yeah.
But that wraps up our summary of these first three chapters. We're already kind of getting into it because we can't wait to talk about this book. We can't help it. But let's now talk about our first impressions and perhaps even our predictions of what's to come in the book. I'll kick it off for us, Obsa. This is such a heavy way to open a book, right? Like, it's tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. Not one, but two betrayals in a mere three chapters in a short, like, opening 50 pages.
Yeah.
And my heart really goes out to poor Ye. She has already seen in her short life some of the darkest parts of humanity, thanks to this political and social tidal wave of the Cultural Revolution. Her family, her friends, her loved ones have all suffered because of it, and she, as a result, has suffered because of it. I think there's a quote I want to share here that particularly illustrates the mindset that Ye is in at the end when she joins up with Red Coast Base. Quote, "It was impossible to expect a moral awakening from humankind itself, just like it was impossible to expect humans to lift off the earth by pulling up on their own hair. To achieve moral awakening required a force outside the human race. This thought determined the entire direction of Ye's life." End quote.
Oof. Wow.
If that's not a condemnation of humanity, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
She's out here like, there's no hope for these fuckers.
Yeah.
And it's understandable, right? We can't fault her for thinking that way after what we have witnessed happen to her in these opening chapters. It's horrible. And honestly, I was kind of like, yeah, girl, sign up for Red Coast Base. Don't go back out there. Out there, it's just like death and tragedy. Maybe in this base, she'll be secluded from the world, which is exactly what she wants. She wants that safety of being somewhere outside of the world and away from humanity.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of Red Coast Base, it's clear to me that there's a larger mystery here about this base. It's not just like sending signals to a satellite or something out there. Like, birds are fucking falling out of the sky.
Well, right.
Clouds are glowing blue. Like, something's going on with Red Coast Base.
Something is going on, yeah.
And I'm excited to see how this mystery will slowly unravel across the book. These first three chapters to me really feel like an extended prologue of sorts, right? Minor spoiler for what's to come, but the rest of the book takes place 60 plus years later in like the early 2010s-ish. So this really is like a flashback to the 60s and to the height of the revolution. And it feels like an extended prologue. A little fun fact that I dug up in my research for today's episode is that in the original publication of the book, in the original Chinese publication, these three chapters that dealt with the Cultural Revolution actually fell somewhere in the middle of the book. And it wasn't until the English translation in 2014 that they were actually pushed to the front to be like an opening prologue of sorts.
Wow.
And the reason for this is because the Chinese publishers were worried about state censors, so they quote unquote hid or buried these very politically charged chapters later in the book.
Wow.
So I found that really interesting. about the placement of these chapters and how it changed from the original publication. So to wrap up my impressions here, I do want to say I'm very interested to see where the book goes, because it seems clear to me that we're setting up a first contact story with Ye Wenji at its center at some point.
Yeah.
And I do have to admit to our listeners, full transparency here, I read the book back in 2020 during the height of the pandemic. And because time didn't matter back then, I frankly don't remember it at all. I'm rereading it now, and much of this is like totally new to me again. But I do remember how it made me feel. And I remember not liking it, which is interesting. Yeah. I remember thinking it was too slow. I remember thinking it was too dense, too much psi and not enough phi for my tastes, frankly.
Okay.
But that having been said, I want to come into our discussions and this podcast and this deep dive reread with an open mind. And I'm actually very much looking forward to a slower, more analytical read of this book with you. And I'm excited to see how our discussions may change my perspective on it.
Yeah. I'm just as excited to be diving back into this because, spoiler, I too have read this book. And in my case, it may have been before the pandemic, but I have a notoriously terrible memory.
Okay.
So it does feel fresh and totally new to me. I'm fairly certain I couldn't leak any spoilers if I tried. So I'm in the same boat as our readers, hopefully, who haven't read too much past chapter 3
right
as well. But all to say, you know, I've read a handful of Liu Cixin's works. More than one means I like what I've read.
Mm-hmm.
And that is holding true now for this read through of Three Body Problem. I'm really enjoying it. These early chapters are, to your point, super weighty and tragic. And I think that anchors you into this reflective mind space that we're finding ourselves in now, you know, where you're contemplating the individual human sorrows. Yeah, Wenji and her father and really her whole family, but also the collective project of humanity. You hear and see some of the things we've done in the past. And when you stop to reflect on it, it, you know, it might challenge your perception of our progress as a species.
Yeah.
That certainly seems to be what's happening for, yeah, at least. So it's interesting to hear that these first chapters were buried in the middle and then brought out to the front. So I guess that's how he probably originally envisioned it. And I have to say, I like that choice. This thread around Ye Wenji that we're following is a fictional but historically plausible one from a tumultuous time in China's past. And the way the narrative is presented, you see the world simultaneously from her perspective and her family's, as well as perhaps an external observer reflecting on the broad story and arc of the human race. So that kind of dual perspective I found to be kind of really compelling, and to have kind of achieved that in just these first three chapters was really impressive.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think we all recognize the personal injustice of Ye Jitai as well, and the nobility of his courage through the violence and betrayal he suffered. He is, of course, the professor that we saw at the beginning during the struggle session.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, we're presented with a few individuals that we deeply empathize with, and on the other, we're witnessing the familiar, ugly, fallible, misguided species we collectively are at times. So I don't know. I mean, Liu Cixin has been pretty vocal, I think, that this isn't a political book. But these chapters do present a serious indictment.
Yeah.
You know, if not of a specific party or clique, then again, maybe humanity or humanity's past, at least.
Yeah, definitely. It is interesting that he presents it as a non-political book. And he has made claims that he's just trying to tell a good story and he's not trying to make any sort of commentary on modern China or Chinese politics or global politics. I think there's a bit of talking out of the side of his mouth on purpose, perhaps to protect himself from said state censors that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, he's clearly very historically read, and we know from his background, and we'll talk about that, of course, next, that he he has a background in science as well. So
yeah.
I mean, without further ado, maybe let's jump right into that. Let's talk about our let's go through our sci-fi analysis. Let's explore the meta behind this book.
Let's after an ad break.
Oh, ad break. Let's cut for a quick ad break and we'll jump right into our meta.
All right, folks, welcome back. Let's continue our discussion about Three Body Problem and get into our deep dive sci-fi analysis starting today. We like to do this at the start of every book with a bit of meta, right? Let's talk about the book outside the book. How did it come to be? And a bit of background on the author. So from my research, I learned that Liu Cixin was born in 1963 in Beijing, and this was just 3 years before the Cultural Revolution broke out, so he was just a baby when that happened. His father lost his job because of the revolution, and the young boy was sent away to his grandparents because it frankly got too dangerous for him as his parents tried to navigate the political turmoil. Now, later in life, around 6 years old, he really became interested in outer space when China launched its first satellite. And he credits his father as being the person who introduced him to speculative fiction, to science fiction stories. And Liu would catch the sci-fi bug basically for the rest of his life. He's a diehard sci-fi fan. He's read all the classics and he loves them. He's inspired by them. Now, after graduating from university in 1988, Liu worked as a computer engineer in the hydropower industry, and he would spend his evenings writing and publishing a number of short stories and novels. None of them really hit up until 2007, when he had his absolutely breakout hit story, Three Body Problem, the very same that we're talking about today. Now, this hit novel was translated by Ken Liu to English 7 years later in 2014, and would go on to win the Hugo Award for the best novel in 2015, making Liu Cixin the first Asian to ever win a Hugo, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And an indictment of the Hugo as well.
That's correct. Always controversial, that Hugo.
Now, speaking of the popularity of this book, the story has been adapted to television, both in China and in the US. So in China, it was adapted by Tencent, and the TV show was released in January 2023. And here in the States, Netflix has released an adaptation of the trilogy, and it's being created by the dynamic duo behind Game of Thrones. Regardless of what you think of them, those first five seasons of Game of Thrones were awesome. And the Netflix show will be dropping, in fact, today, March 21st, 2024. Which perhaps explains why we released this episode today as well. Now, I don't know about you, Opsa, but I will certainly be watching the Netflix show.
Without a doubt.
I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that we may release some bonus episodes on Patreon sharing our thoughts about the show. So if that's something you're interested in, please email us and let us know. And we can talk about the Netflix adaptation as well in bonus episodes. Now, to wrap up a bit of background on the book here, Three Body Problem, as we said, very popular. It had a very positive reception here in the West as well. Critics like Nick Richardson from the London Review of Books went so far as to claim that the trilogy is, quote, one of the most ambitious works of science fiction ever written, end quote.
Wow. Okay.
That makes me want to read the rest, because I will admit I never got past the first book back in 2020. Yeah. Now, Jason Heller's review in NPR was also very positive, a glowing review of the book, but he was a bit more measured than Nick Richardson. Jason said, quote, "This is hard science fiction, full of lovingly lengthy passages of technical exposition about everything from quantum mechanics to artificial intelligence. But Cixin Liu supports all of that brain-twisting theory with empathetic characters and a strong action thriller backbone. That's a lot to set up. And the three-body problem flounders somewhat until it finds its footing." End quote. And I will say, I so far, I think Well, no, I won't say anything. It's too early for me to review this book for three chapters.
Well, and my prediction is that I will review this book at 5 golden problems.
Oh, boy.
So I think it's also worthwhile for us to spare a few minutes on some of the history that serves as a backdrop for these first few chapters, particularly the Cultural Revolution. Let me begin by saying this is a vast, complicated, and super sensitive topic, and one that we certainly can't do any real justice to. But it would also be a shame for us to not bring to the surface the historical events that inform this section and remedy any gaps in our memory.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was out here watching like 45-minute BBC documentary things on YouTube trying to get a grasp on it, and I still feel super confident. So consider this like a very explain like I'm 5 years old basic primer on the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, so let's just share what we've learned, and please do weigh in, jump in on the Patreon and on Discord, and elevate our understanding. So to frame it, this is Maoist era China. That's 1949 to 1976. Mao Zedong is the country's leader, and in fact, officially declared the founding of the People's Republic of China on October 1st, 1949. Leading the new country until his death in 1976.
Wow.
During his leadership and in those early days of the New People's Republic, probably the three most historically significant events were the Great Leap Forward, the Great Chinese Famine, and of course, the Cultural Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
In brief, so the Great Leap saw the country mobilize to leap from an agrarian to modern industrial society. Mao and party leadership wanted to rapidly kickstart a new socialist economy with a strong industrial base moving away from agriculture. This had the disastrous and unintended effect of dramatically reducing agricultural production levels, leading to the next event, the Great Famine. The failure of the centralized planning policies enacted during the Leap initiated one of the largest, if not the largest, recorded famine in history. That's between the years 1958 to 1962, according to Tombstone, and resulted in the deaths of 36 million people.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the estimates vary, and it's a very difficult number to pin down for
right. How do you even count something like that?
But at least according to one resource, in the ballpark of 36 million. And soon after this, well, Mao Zedong saw his political stock faltering. He, of course, being an authoritarian leader, blamed the failures on implementation and his political adversaries. And this culminated in basically his campaign to purge any rightist or counter-revolutionary members from society.
Yeah.
And this is the chaotic and violent uprising we know as the Cultural Revolution. It essentially lasted until his death in 1976. So a full decade, essentially.
Yeah, which is a classic tyrant move, right? Oh, all the things that have been going wrong and all the people that have been dying, not my fault. In fact, not even our fault, the party's fault. It's the fault of like insurrectionists and bad faith actors that have infiltrated us. And now we need to purge these people, right? Like that, from my understanding, was the core motivator behind something like the Cultural Revolution.
Exactly.
Mao Zedong needed to find some sort of scapegoat for all the fuck-ups that were happening under his reign, and he decided these anti-revolutionary rightist capitalist thinkers and intellectuals had infiltrated the society and ruined his great plans, right? And that fervor really got to the point where we saw things like the struggle sessions and bloodletting.
Absolutely. It really was the case that there were those struggle sessions, you know, led by young people that were encouraged by Mao and that saw people publicly shamed, beaten, tortured for essentially failing some purity test, party purity test, for being deemed counter-revolutionary, really just being independent thinkers and for not maybe expressing the ardor that Mao Zedong required of his followers.
Right. Which, to be clear, is an impossible test to pass because the goalpost is always moving. And even in the book, I really liked in today's reading where some of the people that are beating Ye's father are like actually a little uncomfortable. They're like, oh, wait a second.
Right.
I don't want to be. But there's a great line in there that said, oh, but they had to keep going because they couldn't look like they were less revolutionary than the person next to them.
Right.
And that sort of mentality, right? Like that you have to constantly prove that you are revolutionary, lest the revolution turn on you.
Yeah, it's a rather weighty section. He, you know, in this section calls out some real historical intellectuals who committed suicide during this Cultural Revolution. There's a footnote about it, and really quite tragic. You know, it's everything from historians to novelists to meteorologists and geophysicists. So there was this mass purge of really a core part of the intellectual leadership of the country during this era. And also, eventually, these riled up Red Guards and other youth were indeed sent off to the forests and farms to work the land, at least partially to disperse them following their madness and kind of the violence of their actions. There's a quote in this section that especially resonated with me. Soon, the young men and women who had once expended their youthful energy on tours to the holy sites of the Chinese Revolution discover that compared to the huge sky and open air of Inner Mongolia, the biggest cities in China's interior were nothing more than sheep pens. Stuck in the middle of the cold, endless expanse of forests and grasslands, their burning ardor was meaningless. Even if they spilled all of their blood, it would cool faster than a pile of cow dung and not be as useful. But burning was their fate. They were the generation meant to be consumed by fire.
Yikes.
Yeah. So the book opens with, you know, scenes from this latter part of Mao era China. And you can feel deeply and painfully the historical injustice of those who were meant to be consumed by fire, those who suffered this tragic and chaotic period. And through these glimpses of Ye Wenji's life, I think this is why we have this flashback or extended prologue. You begin to anticipate that as the novel progresses, her decisions, may reflect a cynical attitude towards humanity. Mm-hmm. And you can understand perhaps why.
Yeah. And I think it's quite powerful to have these chapters in the front of the book.
Yeah.
Because it almost gets you in the right mindset. It gets you in Ye Wenji's mindset to witness all of this bloodshed and humanity getting riled up and this mob mentality way of thinking. Right, prove to me you're a revolutionary or that you're revolutionary enough.
Right.
Even though the goalpost is moving all the time. I think that really does set the scene for the rest of the book. Because as we get into the more science fiction elements of the book, and as we know, this is a first contact story, as we get into all of that, I think Liu Cixin is intentionally wanting us to consider Ye Wenji's view of humanity.
Absolutely. Which I think is the perfect segue into our next section here, the dilemma. Let's talk about the big questions at the heart of this novel, and at least the ones that we're exposed to in these first couple of chapters. Kind of building on what you just said there, I think that is one of the dilemmas that we're confronted by, and it's really the question of humans and humanity. It does sometimes seem like it's humans versus humanity, or humanity versus humans, where collectively we accomplish great things. Like our civilization has continued to grow because we've adapted and grown and learned to use tools and communicate and work together. And that represents some sort of progress. But we also see that at moments our worst qualities are brought out when we are brought together and perhaps led under a common and ill motive, or perhaps a good motive with poor implementation. I don't know, but there's this dilemma between humanity and humans where, you know, it's this real versus Platonic kind of split, where the Platonic human is really quite lovely. You know, like we love humans, right? We're on the side of human, like we're pro-human, of course,
Of course,
at least on this podcast, I think.
Particularly humans named Ana de Armas. We're very pro. We're extremely pro Ana de Armas on this podcast.
I've been told that, and on the other hand, of course, we have real humans, and the contrast I think that is already being evoked is that between our ideals and our practices, that's the one that at least particularly jumped out at me in this section.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, these opening three chapters, we're not even thrust into the story of this book yet.
Right.
Again, it's really just a prologue that sets the scene, that sets our mood, sets our mindset, and introduces us to Ye Wenji. But I couldn't agree more. There are these bigger questions being asked already in the book about whether humanity is almost even worth saving, right? Like, if this is a first contact story and humanity is about to get in touch with aliens, the question is, like, should we just let the aliens, like, do their shit? Like, are we even worth saving? Because, like, look at what humanity is capable of. Look at the depths to which we will plunge. But I would argue there are many counterexamples of humanity overcoming these dark urges, overcoming these pitfalls, and actually proving that the best of us, as long as we are loud, we are vocal, we stand up for what we believe is right, the best of us can come together and pull humanity at large out of the darkness. So I think there is a heavy amount of cynicism at the start of this book, which, of course, as we've discussed, feels intentional, feels like it's setting up the rest of the story. But I personally am in the camp of maybe being a bit of a hopeless romantic, maybe being a bit of a hopeless optimist. But I do believe that Ye Wenji has seen the worst of us, but has not experienced the best of us. And that colors her perspective on it.
Right.
And the question of whether we're worth saving, I would argue we are, because I think humanity has proven time and time again that we are capable of equally beautiful and equally awful things.
NASA, I hope you're listening. We will be transmitting this to the aliens. Please cut out the rest of the episode and just this short clip where we defend humanity potential alien suitors.
Yes, absolutely. Aliens.
We're not that bad.
We're not.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Okay.
We all make mistakes.
You know?
Forgive and forget.
Exactly.
Great point. We're going to shoot this right up to space, and hopefully aliens will listen to this podcast and
I agree.
Realize that there is some hope.
Yeah. I totally agree, though, with the point you're raising. And I think there is like maybe, perhaps the optimistic way of looking at it is that this is contrasting our past with our present and future. Maybe we'll see kind of humanity evolve over the course of this novel and over the course of the series. That said, I think another theme that emerges is perhaps totalitarianism. Like we saw and we have seen the failures of that in human history. And given we know or suspect that this is going to be a first contact novel, we have to wonder if that'll be a characteristic of the beings that we encounter, or whether we'll find anything recognizable about them at all. Perhaps we'll be talking left and up, like perhaps there is no real communication channel between us. But
perhaps those aliens will be goddamn socialists.
That would be the worst. I think that's the point Liu Cixin has been making, is that socialism bad?
Yeah. I did want to point out one last thing that you have in our notes here that I really, really liked as far as the dilemmas that we've been presented in the book so far. is from the very first chapter. This really poignant idea of science versus policy slash politics, right?
Right.
Clearly, Ye Wenji's father believes in science. Science first, in fact. He believes that after testing and verifying and experimenting, we can find some truths about ourselves and about the universe, and those truths should then dictate policy, how we dictate our societies and our thoughts. The Cultural Revolution, on the other hand, and the Red Guard that are riled up by all of this politics, is the inverse of that.
Right.
Your theory of relativity is capitalist, motherfucker, and that doesn't align with Maoist thought, with the politics and policy of the day. Your science has to adhere to what we say is politically and morally correct,
right,
instead of the other way around. And personally, I agree with Ye Zetai here. I think the book is also making it clear that Ye Zetai is in the right and that the Cultural Revolution is in the wrong, that policy and politics shouldn't come first and shouldn't dictate science, and that scientific discoveries should be how we then create our societies and our politics and our policies. I'm curious what you think about that, though. Do you agree? Or are you more of a, like, stick to Maoist thought?
Yeah, I have been saying make Mao great again for for too long. I certainly agree. I'm certainly of the opinion that that policy and that our kind of governance, collective governance, should flow from a base of commonly agreed principles, and those should be as much as possible rooted in our best understanding of the world that we live in.
Yeah.
And rational thought. And right now, the thing that, like, the tool that we have developed that is the best at giving us a coherent and consistent picture of the world is science. Like, that is, you can stack it up against other things that we have tried, and the tea leaves ain't mathin'. Mm-hmm. Like, they're, mm-hmm, you know, it's, I think we find that science gives us that reproducibility and just, like, an ability to make solid predictions about the future from what we currently know.
Right, absolutely.
Though that said, and I think it hasn't become a feature of these chapters yet, so perhaps we'll save a more thorough discussion of this till later, but the title, Three Body Problem, refers to a very classical problem that we cannot solve to the best of our abilities.
It does,
with what we know with math and science and our kind of rational thoughts thus far. So,
yeah, much more to talk about that in later chapters, because it really comes into play.
Absolutely. But all to say, totally agree. And this is perhaps part of the, this is perhaps one of the threads that will follow as the story continues and
certainly
we find ourselves in the more modern era.
Certainly. And I do want to thank you for giving me ammunition to cancel you, because you have now on the record said the words, make Mao great again.
Oh, no.
And I can clip that out.
Oh, no.
So just know that I hold that above your head forever.
I shouldn't have made all those t-shirts.
Okay, to wrap up our sci-fi analysis, we did want to say one quick thing about the gadget. Normally, we have a segment on the show called The Gadgets, where we kind of geek out about the cool sci-fi technology that's present in many of the books that we'll read on this show. But as we know from these first three chapters, that's not super relevant in the book so far. Like, it's all very grounded in reality. Nothing that's been presented to us in these opening chapters is fictional in really any sense. Like, it's all very much grounded in reality. And you, in your research, had actually dug up an interesting detail about that from the author himself.
That's right. And we'll have to share this in the description notes, but there's this excellent interview that Liu Cixin does with the British Library. And towards the end of it, the interviewer asks him about the role of advanced technology in science fiction. And basically the question he posed to him was, do you think it's the role of science fiction writers to sort of foresee or foreshadow or kind of inspire our imagination with plausible technology of the future? Basically, is it part of their kind of responsibility, given there is so much that science fiction has predicted?
Metaverse and hoverboards.
Absolutely. I mean, really, just about everything. you've got your Apple Watch on, and you've got a communication device that you can use to call somebody on the other side of the planet, which, I mean, is almost a trope in science fiction, but is, in fact, something that was predicted by it. And Liu Cixin, and Cixin basically says, surprisingly, no. And, in fact, says that though it has been the case that science fiction has often written about things that came to, in fact, be produced or real, that generally science fiction writers are trying to come up with things that are not plausible, like things that are so far-fetched and outside the realm of imagination as to be a really compelling creative narrative device. So less something that they use to make their own sorts of futurist predictions about what will pass, so much as really part of the craft of writing. And in his case, I think, and in the case of some of the science fiction writers that we'll cover in this podcast, he does happen to have a technical background. So I think some of the things that he writes about we'll come to see do reflect perhaps our best understanding of science today, but I expect that he'll also make leaps into the realm of this is completely outside of what we know. Or at least that's an open question that we'll have to revisit as we complete this novel.
Yeah, it's an interesting take from him, because I imagine, I don't know, I'm not a sci-fi author, but I imagine many authors like to not necessarily like predict that this will happen, but to take something to a further extreme and to get into the realm of fiction, but just realistic enough that maybe, like back when Snowpiercer was written in the 90s, who would have thought that the metaverse would be a thing we'd all be jacking into in our Apple Vision Pros in 2024?
Right. Yeah. My gosh. That's right. Did pre-orders go out last week? Incredible. Yes.
I'm going to be playing with one next week. So.
Oh! Yeah.
I didn't buy one.
I'm so jelly.
A friend of mine bought one, and he's going to the Apple Store to pick it up and then immediately come over
here. So jelly. Yeah. That's great.
He texted me last week, and he was like, I have good news and I have bad news. Bad news first, I'm out $4,000. Good news, I'm coming over next week with the Apple Vision Pro.
Oh my God. Holy shit. That's incredible.
Yeah. Well, that wraps up today's episode, but we do have homework for you. We'll always assign you homework for the next reading, dear listener. So for the next episode of this podcast, make sure that you've read chapters 4, 5, and 6, the next three chapters of Three Body Problem. And if you ever have a question about what you should be reading and what you should be prepared for each episode, not to worry, check out the show notes. We will always have our entire seasonal reading schedule with dates and chapters and books linked down below. So check that out. Right. Make sure that you are prepared for the next episode and that you've done the reading so that you can enjoy it when it drops.
That's right. You'll also, of course, find the Patreon and Discord links there as well. So please do come join us in conversation, perhaps be featured on the podcast. Who's to say?
We do make this podcast.
I suppose
are the only ones to say.
That's fair. Well, don't forget about Mao. Mao always has the final say.
That's right. This podcast will strictly adhere to Mao's thought.
That's right.
Policy first, podcast second, as we always say.
Well, friends, this struggle session has come to an end.
And luckily, no lives have been lost.
So help us spread the word of this banned podcast and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
And be sure to check out the other shows on the Lore Party Podcast Network on loreparty.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @lore_party.
Thank you so much for listening. And remember, you can either commit to this podcast for life or go back to prison and face the consequences. Choose wisely.